Morning, everybody. Welcome to the first day of spring and the snow that went with it. We're glad to have brothers and sisters to see on the first day of the week, and we also welcome friends who are present with us today. Through these winter months, we have been involved in a study of Matthew chapters 5 through 7, the great Sermon on the Mount of the Lord Christ. Today we're going to use both of our services this morning and then also this evening to finish up our journey through these important chapters. I want to mention that tonight what we will do will be quite different it will still be right, but it will be a different approach. It will be a little more brief, also to allow us some time to enjoy the LTC presentations after service tonight. So hope you can be with us then. You know, that moment comes even for the Sermon on the Mount. The moment when the talking is all done and when the impressions are being felt and when the hands have to turn back again to the chores of life. And the measure of the sermon, maybe even more, the measure of the hearers is what then? That moment is described in our text today at the very end of Matthew chapter 7. It's easy to overlook, and I'm hoping we won't. Here's what it says. And when Jesus finished these sayings, the crowds were astonished at his teaching. For he was teaching them as one who had authority, and not as their scribes. When he came down from the mountain, great crowds followed him. You know, on the surface, what happens here is pretty much a natural bookend to the way this whole story started in Matthew 5, verses 1 and 2. Back there were the crowds, and the Lord's going up on the mountain, and then his sitting down, and the teaching that we have been trying to think our way through. But now, he finishes these sayings, and he comes down from the mountain again, and great crowds are coming with him and following him. But really, under the surface, if you think about it, it's pretty plain that nobody is through with this teacher. His sermon may be completed, but the authority of this teacher continues. The fact is that our brief text is more than just an incidental detail. It is instead the connector to the rest of the Gospel of Matthew. And it sets the Sermon on the Mount in a very important, a very necessary context. And a lot of the questions that people have about the way this sermon is supposed to be used depend on our making this same connection in our minds. So I hope you'll give a little thought with me to this idea this morning. Let's begin by just noticing that when he came down from that mountain, the one thing that was happening was that the people were astonished at his teaching. There was enough about what he taught, of course, to astound anybody. The scope of this teaching, for example, has gone all the way from the dispositions of a person to the passions and emotions to the person's words and promises to how one responds to the impositions of other people in his life, all the way from that to the deepest motivation of a person, whether he's seeking God's approval or whether he's playing to the crowd, to his worst anxieties, to his highest aspirations, to the way he evaluates people and what he shares of himself with other people and whether he can be kind to them, and then to whether he will act upon the opportunity to enter into life itself. All of that in this teaching. Besides that, there are the lofty standards. And the way these standards exceed, or perhaps even completely reverse, the way everybody has heard it before, or the way we may be thinking now. I mean, who had thought about not only what you do, but how you think? Being the matter that turns your life, and not only whether you're good to people, but how you respond to people who are not good to you. Who thought about that all being involved? And then there are the consequences the Lord says are attached to this way of living. Your house stands or falls, according to Him, based on whether you take this kind of action. So what He taught is impressive. But what astonished the crowds that day was not so much what He taught, but how He taught. He had taken upon Himself to teach not by citing the traditional understanding that had been written down by the rabbis held to by the fathers. He hasn't even taught with a "Thus saith the Lord," like Moses would have. He taught instead as one who had authority in and of himself, as one who had the right to speak and the right to expect that people will be responsible to his words. He uses "I say to you" in some form 12 or 14 times in this sermon. And two more times he makes reference to these words of mine. And he speaks as if he knows who is blessed and how life works and what his Father will do. And in fact, that God is his Father and that he himself will be the judge that people answer to based on how they've responded to him. Now you think about this with me for a moment. How he taught must mean that what he taught continues in force. How he taught must mean that you and I cannot walk down the mountain figuratively, having thought through the Sermon on the Mount, and then be through with it. Unless, of course, Jesus doesn't really have any authority, in which case we would have the odd circumstance of having the highest ethical model ever presented to come from a man who was making claims that were not true about himself. The Sermon on the Mount, then, is not a social manifesto, but it's God's will for human beings. It's not all of his will that Jesus taught, but it is practical guidance that goes with the other doctrines of the New Testament and gives life to them. And it's not an impossible vision of humanity meant to cause us to be absorbed with our own weaknesses. It's what Christ intends to make of us when we're under his rule over a lifetime. All of those views of the sermon are important as we proceed. Now, that brings us to the way this attaches to the rest of the gospel. The rest of the gospel of Matthew allows us to see how the Lord assumed that the teaching of the Sermon on the Mount would be applied by the people who were hearing him. It seems to me that the context straightens out a lot of misunderstandings of that the impact the sermon is meant to have on us should be. Let's try to summarize it like this. And I've broken up the Sermon on the Mount in my own way in reading here. And I'll jot down the broader passages, and we'll make some references to specific passages in between that I'll not take time to read, so think about them with me. It is assumed in this gospel that we'll be attending to the kinds of things Jesus has taught us in the sermon, where we are abiding in the midst of the harassed and helpless world, as the end of Matthew 9 describes it. In other words, all these high and lofty goals that and instructions that the sermon offers to us are expected to be used in a world where people, including ourselves sometimes, are distressed and scattered. A world where there's every kind of hurt and danger and sin, along with all of their consequences. Please think of this when you notice Matthew chapters 8 and 9. The Lord comes down from the mountain, and then there's a series of 10 mighty works of His that deal with disease and storms and paralysis and so forth, and where He rubs shoulders with Levi and Levi's friends, Matthew and his friends, and the problems in their lives. We haven't been talking about simply wild religious theory as we've been reading the Sermon on the Mount. We're talking about a way to keep our compass set when we have to deal with swirling life that's all around us. This is not a sermon for a perfect world. It's a sermon for this world. Secondly, notice that it is assumed in the Gospel of Matthew that we'll be attending to these matters while we are trying to wisely and innocently and courageously address our own purpose in this sermon, in this world. Matthew chapters 10 through 15 show what I mean, and by innocently, I don't mean that we'll somehow magically be free from any weakness. I mean that we'll be sincere, that we'll be unassuming, that we'll not be flamboyant, that we won't be putting on a show or any of that. We'll just be regular people who are attending to our tasks in life. We'll meet, these chapters show, we'll meet questioning and criticism and stubbornness. In other words, we'll deal with people, but we'll do so with the understanding of a sower who knows that the different kinds of soil react to the seed quite differently. And we'll do so with a sense of personal integrity, where we want our words to match what really is going on in our hearts. And we may face wolves, but we'll do so as wise as serpent, but as innocent as doves. That idea, even though there's danger all around us. These chapters are helpful in telling us to keep our eyes on Christ, like Peter when he started out across the water, remember? And he did fine for a few steps, but then he looked at the waves and the storm instead of Jesus, and he started sinking. Surprise, surprise. And then that we use what we have, like the disciples when there were thousands of people needing to be fed. Jesus just asked them, well, what do you have? And they brought that to him, and he made it enough. That's the way he works on us. Thirdly, Matthew shows us that we'll be attending to the things that Jesus has taught us in the Sermon on the Mount when we are remaining assured that His identity as the Christ is the main thing, the central fact of history. Matthew moves along until we get into chapter 16, and with everything else going on, the key question turns out to be, who do you say that I am? And then their confession, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God, sustains them through their own misunderstandings and through the controversies that they have to meet in the world. The thing that matters is that He's the Son of the living God, And we must listen to him as they learned at the Mount of Transfiguration. The Mount of Transfiguration and the Sermon on the Mount should go together in our thinking. This is my son. I'm well pleased in him. Listen to him. That one great fact is like the north point on the compass that keeps bringing us back to the main thing. And then we'll be attending to these matters, Matthew shows us, while we are trying to relate in a healthy way to those who share this conviction about Christ with us. Matthew chapters 18 through 22. It's surprising how much of the Gospel of Matthew turns out to be about how people in the crowd following Jesus are supposed to get along with each other. Have you noticed that? There'll be times whenever we'll have personal agendas and we're wondering who's the greatest. There'll be times when we realize we have an influence on each other and we could cause each other to stumble, or times when we rub each other wrong and we need both to seek forgiveness and to grant it. All through this, Matthew teaches us to make sure we are valuing humility and respecting the Lord's goodness and his right to be gracious to who he wants to be gracious to, and meeting our own obligation to love. That's where Matthew 22 sort of ends. And then the fifth line of thought, this is a crucial one. Matthew assumes that we'll be attending to what Jesus taught with humble confidence in the redeeming work of Christ, offered in death, raised in triumph, ascended to glory, all for us. Matthew chapters 23 through 28. This account of Jesus' arrival at Jerusalem, his conflict with the authorities, and then the way he was let down by the humanness of his friends, and then the dignity with which he conducted himself through illegal trials, and the way he gave himself up for us when he would not have had to, is so much a part of our thought that we remember it every Lord's Day. The redeeming work of Christ deserves our confidence. Confidence in that he confronted evil as one establishing a covenant by his own blood and not as a martyr or as a helpless victim. And confidence in that he did this in the shadow of the mistakes of his friends and their failures, and when their self-confidence was shattered, and when they themselves were scattered, and when human limitations were most obvious. So what does this context that we've tried to show in these five statements mean to us? What does it tell us about the Sermon on the Mount? Well, most importantly maybe that, of course, living this way will not be simple and easy for anybody. You don't wake up one morning doing this completely. It is not assumed that we'll achieve perfection in its application all the way down to our thoughts and motives right away. It is assumed that this is a perfect goal which is worthy of struggling toward, and that doing so will produce a recognizable lifestyle, and that nobody can follow Christ long without it. That's the crucial thing. Now, I want to look back just a moment now. Knowing where this gospel leads, I want to think back with you for a moment within the sermon. and to ask that we try to think of what a person who has faith enough to commit himself to this way of living will need to have faith enough to realize is happening while he's living this way. Number one, as we live this way, the effect within ourselves, according to Jesus, is righteousness. It's practical goodness from healthy motives in all areas of life. It's character like God's and not character like the pagans or the hypocrites that Jesus has mentioned. And then as we live this way, the impact upon the world is restraining and enlightening influence. Salt and light, in other words. Preservation and good taste, and then understanding and hope in our families and in our associations and in our communities. This way of life is needed. And as we live this way, the fruit for God is a people, a kingdom for the King, where His will is being done in real life. Servants for the Master. Children for the Father. Children who imitate Him and seek His approval and trust His care. That's the main goal of the Sermon on the Mount. We're not saying that effects like these are immediately noticeable to the person who's doing this, but that this is the quiet impact of living like this over time. Remember, this is what the Lord says happens. It's His work. When we will say that we've noticed in experience that when we find people who are growing, then the practice of what Jesus teaches here will be involved. We will say also that when we have people who fall out, the failure to respect some part of what Jesus said on that mountain is almost always involved. Either a temperament that's not like the Beatitudes, or anger or passion and letting them, those kinds of things run away, or an inability to make a commitment and stay with it, or the pursuit of the world instead of heaven, or playing like you're following Christ instead of genuinely seeking the Father's approval, judging or being judged, not responding well to the way you feel like other people have either offended or imposed upon you. The Sermon on the Mount, if you've been paying attention, has been a course in mental health, in good family life, and living as a citizen in the world where there are dangers, in honoring and serving God in our religious lives, and of becoming a human being whose life will last. How powerful is the Sermon on the Mount in its context? Well, you might say it this way. Living this way got Jesus killed, but it also made Him an overcomer. I think that's the right way to look at it. That's the way this passage is placed in the Gospel of Matthew. It causes us to think about it. So when we started this study, we asked ourselves to think of what it would have been like to have been there on that mountain when He sat down and started to teach and have heard it. So now imagine what it would be like to have heard it all and to be coming down from the mountain wondering what to do about it and deciding what to do about Him and just how far to follow Him after all. And thinking about it, wouldn't that be something like, considering his claim on our lives now and deciding what to do about his calling all of us through the gospel? I think it would be something like that, don't you? It's the call of authority, loving authority, in our best interest. And it's an invitation to believe him and in him so much that we're willing to say so and to be baptized into him and then to follow him all the way to the end of our days. Maybe you can see that it makes a difference how we live and that this is the ideal that the Lord laid before us here. Maybe you've been intending at some point through this series to make the good confession and to be baptized into Christ. If so, let us help. We love it. And it may be that you've seen ways in which you need your brothers and sisters to pray with you about some of this. And if that's the case, please let us know as well today by coming while we stand and sing.